Part 3. Chinese Lessons. 11. Let's do math. Chinese children are superior to U.S. children in every domain. Number and operation, geometric shapes, problem solving, and reasoning. A cross-cultural research team on the math skills of first graders in New York and Beijing. Teacher Song had proposed the forbidden at Songqing Ling.
We'll be teaching math through tests, in-class activities, and real-life application, she told a group of parents, assembled for the purpose of understanding her academic goals for the middle-class year.
Even though she'd uttered a violation of ministry reform policies against teaching academics to kindergartners, we 15 parents huddled over a rosewood table, complicit, faces blushing with desire for toddler arithmetic. No one wanted to lessen the burden, if it meant our kids would trail a faceless mass of competition, comprised of the roughly 18 million babies born in China each year.
The children will count numbers below 20 and learn about progress relationships, such as 5 is one step higher than 4, Teacher Song told us as we nodded eagerly.
Rainey was just a touch over 5 years old at the midway point of the middle class year. While I'd launched my frenzied quest to affirm our educational choices, he had quietly morphed into a proper student who happily sat with his Mandarin tutor each day, prepared his own backpack for school, and nodded at teachers as he sailed through the entrance gates. After all the difficult cultural and behavioral adjustments we'd made, might we finally taste our reward? A number of upsides were keeping us inside the system, and with the help of educators and experts, I'd narrowed these down to a handful of features. Math teaching was one of them. Later that week, Rainey brought home a counting exercise, covered in the teacher's bright red slashes. Did you do this worksheet in class, Rainey? I asked.
Yes,
he said, looking forlorn. On the sheet was a building with 6 floors, and each floor was subdivided into 7 units. Each of the resulting 42 squares was numbered in sequence, starting with 101 for the first floor and 201 for the second floor, and blanks awaiting a school child's pencil were scattered throughout the grid. This required a basic understanding of triple-digit numbers. First, 101, 102, then comes what, Rainey? I asked him, but my inquiry met with silence. Is this too advanced for a child so young? I wondered. Clearly, Teacher Song didn't think so, and she scribbled a prescription for us. Needs to work harder, she'd scrawled in red across the top of the page. She also broadcast a grade, 6 of 8 possible points. As I pondered this number, my son glanced up at me. Clearly, he felt I should shoulder some blame for those missing 2 points.
Mom, why aren't you teaching me math and how to read and stuff? He asked. Long Long's mom is teaching him to read English, and Mei Mei's mom is teaching her how to add.
I'd begun working numbers into everyday conversations with Rainey, but such forays usually fell flat, interrupted by inquiries about anything that happened to catch his fancy. Rainey's attention span needs fixing, as Teacher Song had told me. My conversations with Rainey typically went something like this.
Your baby brother is 1 year old, and you are 4, I'd say. When Landon is 2 years old, you'll be 5. When Landon is 3, when I grow up to be daddy's age, will I have a baby?
He'd interrupt. Yes, you can have a baby if you want, I'd tell him.
Who will be my baby?
Rainey would say. You'll have to find someone to have a baby with.
Baby Landon can't be my baby?
Rainey would say, pointing to his little brother wiggling nearby on the floor. No, because Landon won't always be a baby, I'd say, spotting an opportunity. You will always be 3 years older than Landon. So when Landon is 7, you'll be what?
Will I need to marry someone to have a baby?
I'd typically answer that, married or not, it's best to be in a solid relationship with someone willing to co-parent because raising a child, especially one who's always asking questions, is utterly exhausting. Clearly, I was no model parent when it came to teaching math. To make matters worse, for my ego. I came across a report comparing math abilities in Chinese and American kids as young as 5. I devoured the study. What advantages would Rainey earn from his time in Chinese kindergarten? Would I be negating those with my laid-back style at home? Lead researcher Jenny Zhengzhou grew up in China and is now a professor in New York City. She and her team focused on students in the two international cities she knew best, New York and Beijing, tapping the children just a month into their first year of elementary school to minimize the influence of formal math classes. Their findings were unequivocal. Chinese children are superior to U.S. children in every domain: number and operation, geometric shapes, problem solving, and reasoning, Zhou and her researchers wrote. As young as 6 years old, there's already a gap? I delved deeper. Zhou and her team had asked kids to perform a number of tasks. On the easy stuff, such as counting to 10 and reading and writing numbers, American and Chinese scores were virtually indistinguishable. The gap became apparent with the more complex tasks. Chinese kids named many more 2D and 3D shapes. They scored 2 times better on addition and subtraction of numbers under 10. They completely trounced the American children on mathematical word problems, such as a question asking children to distribute objects equally among a given number of friends. Altogether, Chinese kids scored 84 to American kids 60 points in mathematical knowledge. Why was this? The researchers offered a theory. Mathematics skill is present in all cultures, they wrote, but it will develop to a greater extent in those cultures that value it more highly. You'll see hints of this cultural value strolling through a park in China, said Liu Jian, a mathematician who helped develop China's national curriculum.
Just this weekend, I saw a grandma take her 4-year-old grandchild to the square and collect small stones. They started counting together. In our culture, doing things like this is a part of childhood life. We've counted since we were young.
Darcy's parents taught him to memorize mathematical facts from a very young age.
It's very important for your son to memorize chongfabia, times tables, Darcy told me.
Head bent over a cup of coffee, he produced a pen and began outlining a 9x9 grid on a napkin.
Many children can do this before primary school. And in primary school math examinations, we'll have 5 minutes to do 50 questions.
As he started populating the grid, finger movements speeding up as he scribbled, I grew anxious.
It's okay, Darcy assured me. Just make sure your son can memorize the basics. It will make the more complex concepts in school easier to learn.
Amanda had a simple explanation for Chinese math prowess. We're not afraid of it, Amanda told me. And we start practicing really young. When Amanda was just 3, her mother had started exposing her to math through puzzles. A wall is 10 meters high. A snail climbs up 5 meters in a day, but when he sleeps, he falls back 2 meters. How many days does it take to get up the wall? While most Westerners are still toddling about in diapers, Amanda was already potty trained. And she could chirp the answer. The snail reaches the top in 3 days. My parents had always impressed upon me the importance of math, and my sister and I swallowed their mantra and carried it with us to Houston public schools. There, I always found it astonishing that large handfuls of my classmates were happy to trumpet the fact that they struggled in geometry or chemistry. Some even wore it as a badge of honor. In American high school culture, generally, coolness and proficiency at math or science were sometimes mutually exclusive. One particularly keen psychologist dubbed the social costs of academic success the nerd penalty. I'd clashed with my parents on many ideas, but we were aligned in our belief that math was critically important to learn. It's not that I was a geek who was cornered at recess or got picked last for dodgeball teams. In reality, I was a dancer with a triple turn. I spoke conversational French. And I became a captain of my drill team senior year, the ultimate crowning inside a Texas high school. But I also found satisfaction in working my way through a complex algebraic equation. I considered it comforting to know an answer existed, and I enjoyed the finality of landing upon it. I was also drawn to English literature and essay writing, which usually launched a journey of emotion and contemplation. But sometimes I simply wanted to solve for X. Delving deeper, it turns out that early math skills are actually correlated with higher academic achievement later in life, as well as earning potential. Early academic skills, particularly in math, are the single most important factor in predicting later academic achievement, says a researcher who analyzed data from 35,000 preschoolers. A London-based think tank found that math skills developed during primary school continue to matter for earnings 20 to 30 years down the line. Math SAT scores predict higher earnings among adults, while verbal SAT scores show no such correlation. Though I wondered how the study accounted for cases like me, who aced the math SAT but chose to become a writer, a profession in which paychecks might come once a decade. There are also benefits unrelated to bank accounts. People with good math skills are more likely to volunteer, see themselves as actors in, rather than as objects of, political processes, and are even more likely to trust others, according to the OECD. Math skills clearly matter for countries, and plenty of research findings read like gentle encouragements for America, as if it were a nation of bozos who haven't yet mastered long division. Boosting the math proficiency of American students to the level of Canada's or Korea's would increase the annual U.S. growth rate by 0.9 percentage points and 1.3 percentage points, respectively, found a report at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Another report found that automation and an increasingly competitive global marketplace would continue to pinch job opportunities for lower-skilled workers. High-wage countries such as America must adjust, or risk growing income disparities and political instability, wrote the researchers. Policymakers in China don't need to sound such ominous warnings. The Chinese are generally on board, and its modern leaders have long understood the link between technical skills of the population and the health of its economy. Although the Soviet Union's 1957 launch did spur a reorganization in U.S. science education. Deng Xiaoping called science and technology the key to China's modernization after the devastating Cultural Revolution of 1966 to 1976. Jiang Zemin, himself an electrical engineer, promoted rejuvenating the country through science and education during his leadership years from 1989 through the early 2000s. Hu Jintao was a hydraulic engineer who pushed the idea of indigenous innovation and an innovation-oriented country over the past decade. Today, China's ruling class is comprised mostly of scientists and engineers. All this reinforced the choices I'd made for Rainey, though frankly, I could do without the Chinese sense of superiority on this topic. Zhou Nianli, the early education professor I'd befriended, told me once about a visit to an American grocery store gone awry. She'd put $25 worth of goods in her basket, but the cash register had failed mid-checkout. This little speed bump utterly stumped the American cashier. I told her I could tally the bill orally, but the cashier had to wait until the machine was fixed, Joe told me, with a practiced ripple of her fingers that suggested she could recite the first 30 digits of pi while flipping somersaults. The head of assessments at a Shanghai primary school bragged to me that Barack Obama's law degree wouldn't pass muster in China.
In China, maybe Obama would be a mayor, but definitely not president.
Ni sniffed, nose lifted toward the ceiling. I didn't dare ask Teacher Ni for thoughts on President Trump. That got me thinking. Chinese families seemed to value math as a matter of culture. You might say Chinese society awards a nerd bonus rather than subtracts a nerd penalty. But what was happening inside the classroom? How differently did Chinese and American instructors approach math teaching? What would Rainey be learning in China as he got older? And what was the U.S. equivalent? Was one method clearly superior? To find out, I decided to conduct an observational study of my own. In Shanghai, Teacher Ni invited me to visit the primary school where he worked. We'd been introduced by a mutual acquaintance. The following year, I would also visit schools in Minnesota, Massachusetts, California, and New York, eventually deciding to focus on an elementary school in the Boston area. The two math classrooms I chose to write about, one in the center of Shanghai and another in a high-performing school district in Massachusetts, would provide a window into two contrasting approaches. Of course, certain features about the culture and system mean a U.S.-China comparison will never be apples to apples. For one, Chinese schools generally don't mainstream students with special needs, which keeps children of a single classroom moving at closer to the same pace. China also expects that kids will fall out of the system at every level, whereas America prides itself on educating every child. The most sweeping recent U.S. education standards are named No Child Left Behind and Every Student Succeeds. Yet comparing is a useful exercise, James Stigler told me from his UCLA office one summer. Stigler is a psychologist who has spent his career studying education across cultures.
Meaning often emerges through contrast.
He and his co-author Harold Stevenson had written in his book, The Learning Gap.
We do not know what it means to work hard until we see how hard others work. We do not understand what children can accomplish until we have seen what other children the same age can do. So it is with cultures.
Pen and notepaper ready. I looked across cultures. First, Chinese math. Teacher Ni found me at the guard entrance of his Shanghai primary school midweek on a spring day. I followed three obedient steps behind him, down a long corridor on the top floor of the school's main building. In the school's massive courtyard below, I observed several hundred students taking their morning exercises, uniformed children mirroring the movements of their leader. We reached the end of the corridor and stepped inside a classroom.
These are 7 and 8-year-olds,
Ni said, brandishing a hand through the air. Tall and imposing, with a habit of dipping his chin to emphasize a point, Ni carried himself with the import of his position. Are these students academically advanced? I asked, counting 32 heads. These children would be second graders in America.
No, they are normal kids, Ni responded. Average for Shanghai. Some parents taught them academics before they entered primary school, but now we encourage play when they're younger.
His words were white Bible talk, what I use to refer to any government attempt to make education kinder and gentler for its students. But I didn't believe for an instant that these kids had spent hours on the playground as very small tykes. The students sat on gray metal folding chairs, clustered in groups of 6 and 8 around rectangular rosewood tables, chatting animatedly. A slab of clear glass anchored each, and I could see knees neatly tucked beneath, feet flat on the floor. All wore the red crossover necktie that is the hallmark of a Chinese school child. The setup was classic for a traditional Chinese classroom. Cold tile or cement floors, and unadorned walls but for a framed, hanging red and yellow Chinese flag. For an American used to bright, carpeted schoolrooms, the Chinese equivalent often conjured up an empty icebox with a locked access door. Teacher Ni and I took seats at the back of the long, narrow room, and an assistant deposited a Samsung touchpad in my lap. You'll need this for class, she said. At precisely 9 a.m., the master teacher strode into the room from an entrance near the front, and the room immediately settled. A young girl at the second table instantly rose from her chair.
1, 2, 3!
Yelled the girl, her head nodding with each utterance.
Let's read the 12th text, Shi Hu Ming Di. Standing by the West Lake, willow branches swaying. Ready? Go!
Seated and chanting in unison, the chorus of students echoed after her, quickly calling out the words to a popular Chinese poem. Then, without further ado, class begins, announced Teacher Zhou, a slight woman who stood at the front.
Stand up!
Barked the lead girl. 31 chairs squeaked as the students pushed back from the tables. I watched a tide of black-haired heads rise.
Good morning, students, said the teacher, facing her class.
The students responded, then pivoted to the back to find me and Teacher Ni.
And good morning to all teachers!
I'd been swiping at the tablet, and the spotlight was unexpected. I slid a little lower in my seat.
Please sit,
Teacher Zhou said, turning to the blackboard.
Yesterday we learned from a video about square numbers. If I ask you to demonstrate a number squared using dots, can you do that?
We can do that!
The students chanted in unison.
Begin,
the teacher pronounced. 32 heads dropped over 32 electronic tablets, and I counted 80 seconds of silence. The teacher clapped sharply 3 times.
1, 2, 3,
she barked.
Set up straight,
the students chirped, adjusting their backs into ramrod position.
Look up at the screen,
Teacher Joe commanded, as 32 heads pivoted toward the screen at the front of the classroom. Joe pressed a button, and an array of black dots materialized on a grid up front. My Samsung followed suit.
Student number 2, stand up,
Teacher Joe commanded. At Songqing Ling also, I thought, students were often called by number and not name. The boy rose to meet her challenge.
I've made a square number of 4.
Here, Joe began a rapid-fire stream of questioning, inquiries, and answers coming to and fro as quickly as a ping-pong ball bounding across a table.
What is this number?
16.
How did you arrange it? Said the teacher.
4 dots in 1 line.
How many lines?
4.
Please sit. The student lowered himself into the chair, as if an invisible hand were pressing down on his shoulder. The teacher tapped on a screen, and another grid appeared. I marveled that a student's work would be subject to the judgment of 31 classmates at the tap of a teacher's finger.
Number 27,
Teacher Joe said. She was calling on students at random, placing classwork on display without warning. A young girl rose from her chair.
I made 9. Every line has 3 dots, and there are 3 lines.
Number 4,
Teacher Joe said, another grid appearing, another child standing. The back and forth was quick, but I detected no tension or anxiety. What would happen if a student hadn't finished the assignment or marked a wrong answer? Finally, the screen flashed a paper with dots not fully formed.
Someone is still working.
Let's count together for him,
Joe said as the student rose from his chair on cue. In unison, his fellow classmates chanted,
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
The boy stood and listened, intently. To me, his face showed no traces of embarrassment. How will a student catch up if he falls behind? I whispered to Teacher Nee at the back of the room.
If he doesn't grasp the concept, the teacher will alert the parents and require that he buixia, catch up, practice at home,
Teacher Nee whispered back. With her call-at-random approach to in-class exercises, along with scores on tests, the teacher could identify laggards and implement a plan for action. This was impressive, but in almost every other way, I found this classroom jarring to my sensibilities. Buildings in China south of the Yangtze have little or no heating, and this school was no exception. The room was tapered and long, which cemented the teacher as a distant authority figure, separated from her students by the interminability of space and the impersonality of desks. Students were called by number, not by name, which helped order the classroom but also reduced children to a collection of digits. I surveyed the students in their tidy uniforms, heads vibrating with the effort of clapping. I glanced away for a moment and looked back. Not a single student had imprinted in my memory. How does the American math classroom compare? The following fall, a teacher in a Boston area suburb invited me to sit in on a class. Massachusetts has always taken top honors on standardized testing. By this measure, it's among the highest performing states in America. I stepped into Teacher Denise's classroom and was immediately struck by the warmth of the room. The walls were painted a bright aqua color, the floors covered with blue-gray carpet. It was the industrial variety, more suited for insulation and sound absorption than for sinking toes into shag, but it lent a sense of comfort to the classroom. Bulletin boards with backgrounds of indigo blue and bright yellow were spaced along 3 walls, offering a graphical explanation of the Dewey Decimal System, or tips on how to use one's imagination while reading a book. Where the Chinese classroom felt like a metal and glass shoebox,
The American counterpart was an Easter egg basket, with grassy padding and an incubator to keep everything warm.
This is a yardstick, said Teacher Denise, a calm brunette with a steady voice.
Where the Chinese teacher was formidable, planting on 2 feet at the front of the class, Teacher Denise preferred to address her class with weight shifted to one leg, giving her a casual and approachable air. She brandished a length of wood before the class.
How many inches are in a yardstick?
A few dozen 9-year-olds sat before Teacher Denise on the carpeted floor. About a year older than the Chinese students I'd observed in Shanghai, they were dressed casually in long-sleeved t-shirts, pullovers, and comfortable pants. A boy in a sweatshirt shot up his hand.
Matt, said Teacher Denise.
36 inches, said Matt.
Good. Now, class, I have a meter stick here. See the difference? A meter stick is a little bit more than 3 inches longer than a yardstick. If you look closely at a meter stick, you can see tiny, tiny little lines, Teacher Denise said. The bigger lines where the numbers are centimeters, and the smaller lines are the millimeters.
So began a unit on the metric system.
We have the U.S. customary system and the metric system, Denise said. From my seat at the side of the room, the little group of students resembled a carpet picnic. Where the Chinese children sat in uniforms, pressed into rosewood tables, these kids expressed individuality in every way, down to the manner of sitting, cross-legged and upright, legs outstretched and extended, or leaning back casually as if lounging on a pool chaise.
Let's think about what I just said, Teacher Denise continued. We have centimeters and millimeters. They both have prefixes. What other words that you know start with centi or cent?
Cents,
offered a child.
And how many cents make up a dollar?
100,
said another.
100? Are we catching a theme here? What other words are made up of cent? Deshaun?
Centipede?
Century?
Yes.
And take a wild guess. How many years in a century? Teacher Denise asked, moving to sit on the floor, at eye level with her students.
100!
The group moved through the same exercise with milli and deci.
Millipede. Millennium.
Good!
Suddenly, Teacher Denise rose.
Okay, we are going to get into our groups to work on measuring, she instructed, and the room erupted into a flurry of activity.
I counted about 60 seconds before chairs and desks in the center of the room were transported to the edges. Teacher Denise produced a handful of meter sticks. A small group of students dispatched to monitors at the back of the room for FASTT math drills, an individualized program of games that helps students with basic math facts. For the next 15 minutes, the rest of the students measured. They placed rulers against various objects, desks, chair heights, the length of a pen, a pair of scissors, the width of a textbook. In groups, they set about their task, chatting animatedly, heads huddled together, as a designated leader jotted measurements onto a lined piece of paper. Slowly, their voices rose several registers, and Teacher Denise intervened to kill the small talk.
Boys and girls, volume check! Hands in the air! Volume check!
Teacher Denise called out. Each child lifted a hand in the air, quieting for just an instant. In the Chinese classroom, the students competed in a drill.
Now let's BB.
Compare,
said Teacher Zhou, populating the screen up front with a stair-step diagram. The stairs began at the bottom left of my Samsung and escalated toward the right side of the screen. Each step cradled a number.
This staircase is full of traps, Teacher Zhou said, planting herself at the head of the room.
Step only on the stairs that have square numbers, otherwise you will fall. For each square number, you will get 1 star. Let's see who can get 5 stars. Begin!
The class bent over their tablets, and I launched into my time counting. I'd gotten used to measuring the seconds during such periods, marvels of quiet efficiency and productivity. 25 seconds passed. Teacher Joe clapped sharply, and I startled in my seat, as I always did when serene calm is stamped out by a Chinese administrator.
One, two, three, Teacher Joey yelped. How many stars have you got?
A chorus of students erupted.
Five stars!
Now submit your scores.
The students tapped on their screens, and a number materialized at the front of the room. 27.
Ah, there are 27 students who got 5 stars.
That meant 5 children had lost their way, and Teacher Joe scanned her tablet to identify a straggler.
Student number 5, how many square numbers did you find?
A boy stood, a lone figure in his red crossover necktie.
I have 4 stars, 4 square numbers.
Let's do it together,
Joe summoned the group.
What have you found?
The chorus of voices erupted.
16, 1, 81, 49, 100.
Student number 10, what did you leave out?
A second boy stood for his public lesson, then promptly returned to his metal folding chair. I was astounded by the content of the exercise, and I whispered to Teacher Nee, how come such young children have already started learning square roots? Nee laughed.
It's likely parents started to teach them when they were 5, or they were sent to outside classes before they entered primary school.
That's exactly what I'm afraid of, I exclaimed. I'm not doing this with my child at home.
He said. Don't worry. We have a handful of students who are in a similar situation. I'll use a metaphor here. When others around you are dashing to the finish, the desire to run sometimes flames out.
In other words, don't kill the desire to run by pushing too early. Again, these were white Bible words offered in the spirit of lightening academic pressure, although few parents would risk being the only ones listening. Next up was another competition.
Let's see who can make more square numbers than the others, the teacher proclaimed. Begin!
I counted seconds again, and this time I kept going and going. 7 minutes passed before Teacher Joe clapped.
Are you making very big numbers? Joe said.
Yes,
they responded in unison.
Are you excited?
Yes,
the students answered, voices overlapping neatly. The teacher had complete command of the classroom. There was little room for inquisition, and I noted that at no time did a student have the opportunity to respond, as in, no, teacher, I am not excited, and I don't understand.
If I only provide you a sum of continuous odd numbers, can you tell me immediately whose square number is this sum?
Yes,
answered the chorus of voices. I sat in the back, gaping at the screen. In this ordinary Shanghai primary school, these 7 and 8-year-old children were studying. If 1 + 3 + 5 + 7 = 4 squared, 1 + 3 + 5 + 7 + 9 + 11 = x². What is x?
Student number 12, she asked,
surveying her 7 and 8-year-old students.
Did you discover the rule?
A boy rose.
It's the number of addends.
I shrank a little lower in my seat, as if I might be up next if I inadvertently caught the teacher's eye.
Yes, replied Teacher Joe. It's the relationship between addends and square numbers. Let's count how many numbers we have here for the next one.
A chorus of students ticked off.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Teacher Joe nodded, satisfied. Her white sweater billowed as a gust of wind suddenly blew through the classroom through the open door.
Through today's study, we found the beauty of mathematics, she said, nodding at her charges.
On cue, they rose, chairs screeching as they scraped against the tiled floor.
Today's class is over. Dismissed, Teacher Joe said curtly.
The students returned her gesture with a short bow.
Please have a rest, teacher.
Please put away your pens and paper, the teacher said,
as she retreated stage left. I glanced at the children. They rose from their chairs, bodies slanted in the direction of her disappearing back. 32 heads tipped forward in the slightest nod.
In the Massachusetts classroom, the children had started in on fractions, divided into groups of four and five. Teacher Denise crouched next to a girl in a cluster near the door. "How many centimeters in 5 millimeters? Teacher Denise asked, searching the girl's face. The girl was stumped. Teacher Denise prompted her again, gently. "How about this? If you have 50 millimeters, that's how many centimeters?" Teacher Denise tapped on the worksheet in front of the girl. No answer. "Think about it like this. How many centimeters are in a meter?" At this, the girl was confident.
100,
she responded. "Okay, yes. So write that down. All right? All right. So, now think about 5 centimeters. And how many centimeters there are in a meter? So what would be the fraction for 5 centimeters? The girl wrote a number down on her page. "Okay, beautiful," said Teacher Denise. "So 5 of them would be what?" Teacher and student huddled over the page, heads brushing against each other. For a moment, from a distance, they looked like friends. "You have the idea, right?" Teacher Denise asked, glancing at the girl's face, the hope and encouragement clear in her face. Spend 5 minutes in either classroom, and the differences leap out, a chasm in style and expectation, as well as a basic dissimilarity in what is valued, the group versus the individual. The Chinese teacher was the center of gravity in her classroom. She expected full attention, and she got it. In a 35-minute session, she asked 59 questions and called on half of her class at least once, by number, not name, and completely at random. This was her method of sussing out individual progress inside of a group-oriented class. She could easily identify the laggards. Much of her lesson was delivered in lecture format, with in-class exercises cemented by a timed competition. With lessons choreographed down to the minute, she covered a great deal of content. The American teacher was far more approachable. She sat eye level with her students, called them by name. She rarely demanded their attention outright and deployed little tools to capture and hold their interest. She gave few orders and asked only 3 students to answer questions in front of the class. The rest were volunteers. In a 50-minute class, she jumped between lecture format, small group, and one-on-one interactions. While her children were working together in groups, Teacher Denise spent an entire 8 minutes talking to a boy named Matt. She provided many opportunities for a student to say, "I don't understand. Please help." And she told me later that working with small groups allowed her to easily see who's not getting it. I also noted a difference in what researchers call rigor, focus, and coherence, for which Asian math classrooms have always been praised. The Chinese teacher launched a lesson on math facts, square roots, and then directly led the students into a deeper conceptual understanding, relationship between square roots and addends. The American teacher's lesson was less focused on math than on measuring. And when a child failed to understand fractions, how many centimeters is 5 millimeters? She reverted to asking questions the child already knew. How many centimeters in a meter? Rather than pushing onward to deepen understanding. The Chinese teacher commended no one, while Teacher Denise delivered praise throughout the lesson, including the words, "You're brilliant! You're so smart! Smart kids in here! Very good!" The Chinese classroom notched in with a teacher-student ratio of 1 to 32, and did not include students with disabilities. The Americans came in at 1 to 6, with 1 teacher and 2 aides for 18 students, and included students with special needs. Finally, I chuckled, more was expected of a Chinese kid's bladder. Anyone needing the bathroom had to wait until the end of class. The American kids were given more latitude with expression, but less trust with urinary matters. A hall pass had to be had at any time, but must be signed out via roster. "So if there's a problem with the bathroom, and we need to know who peed over the walls, we have a name," Teacher Denise told me, without irony. Of course, a single class is only one part of a lesson that develops across days,
and what works in one part of the world can't necessarily be transferred to another with the same effects. Also, the Chinese teacher delivered a straight concept lesson, while the American one was working on a more open math concept, such as measuring. Even so, dropping into a moment in time, to me, revealed useful insights into education culture. Father Pisa confirmed my observations about classroom dynamics. Assigned this moniker by the Chinese press, Andreas Leischer is the architect of the international standardized test PISA, which spawned hundreds of international headlines. He looked exactly the part. Tall and slender, with shock white hair and a pepper gray mustache, he was the poster image for global standardized testing. Schleicher was eloquent on conference stages and a rock star in education circles. In 2015 and 2016, I traveled to Beijing to meet with him.
"Let's find a quiet place to talk," he said,
shaking my hand as a throng of conference attendees weaved around us. Schleicher is a statistician by trade and German by birth, and over the last decade, to some controversy, he's cultivated the PISA into the gold standard for international education comparison. His pitch goes like this.
"There's a lot we can learn from other countries' education systems, and PISA is the test that tells us which countries deserve a closer look."
When Shanghai students came in number one on math, reading, and science, the result challenged many Western beliefs. Smaller classes are good. Let children run around in open learning environments. Exploration promotes creativity. Eliminate poverty because it's bad for learning outcomes. In essence, Shanghai turned much of this wisdom on its head, logging top scores while featuring exactly the opposite of the common American wisdoms, with such characteristics as large class sizes and authoritarian environments. Of course, critics came out and poo-pooed PISA results. China must have cheated. Shanghai doesn't represent all of China, so how can we draw wider conclusions about the country's education system? Schleicher had an answer for all of them.
Sure, Shanghai isn't representative of China, but Shanghai today is China tomorrow, Schleicher said. These people have spent 1,000 years figuring out how to teach good mathematics. Don't you think there's anything we can learn?
I played devil's advocate. The Chinese spend an entire childhood taking tests, I said. They're good at it. Might that help explain Shanghai's top place finish?
Yeah,
Schleicher said. And before long, I came to understand that this polite affirmation usually preceded a counterpoint.
That explains part of it, but there's so much more to why they do well. Teaching in math particularly deserves a close look because their approach centers on rigor, focus, and coherence. The Chinese put a lot of cognitive demand on students and very high expectations for every child. They teach a few things well, and they have a very good chance of advancing their understanding.
In essence, Schleicher explained, much of the time in a Shanghai classroom is devoted to deep conceptual understanding.
What's probability? What's space? What's the mathematical function? What's relationship?
What about the way Westerners teach math? Is there not more application? I asked him.
Yeah, Schleicher said, nodding. In the US and many countries in Europe, many mathematics lessons are tied to little day-to-day problems, a mile wide and an inch deep curriculum. So you use conceptually quite simple mathematics, embed them in a complicated real-world context, and then we think we are making math relevant to kids. But it is actually a very shallow representation of math.
This Western approach comes out of the idea that memorization and direct instruction are negative, Schleicher says. But in fact, knowledge delivered this way can be a very useful tool.
The Chinese memorize what needs memorizing and use the rest of the time to go very deep in conceptual understanding. Then we are surprised that our Western students don't develop deep conceptual understanding that students in Shanghai do.
Yang Xiaowei arrived at the same conclusion. An education professor at East China Normal University, he recently visited 18 schools in the United States and concluded that the American teaching approach is good in theory,
but doesn't work in reality. There's too much focus on making kids interested in math and on project-based and experiential learning, Young told me. Too little focus on directly teaching math. The student-centered approach that Young witnessed helps kids engage more meaningfully with subjects and better understand classroom content, its supporters say. Kids can also travel at their own pace. Yet, while this type of instruction can be very effective, it also requires training and preparation to deploy it successfully. In fact, the direct instruction favored by the Chinese is better for early learning in many disciplines, especially those with multi-step procedures that students are unlikely to discover on their own, such as geometry, algebra, and computer programming, wrote two professors in a psychological science article. In early science education especially, many more children learned from direct instruction than from self-discovery. A 2015 OECD report found that teacher-directed instruction is actually associated with higher scores in science, and inquiry-based instruction with lower scores. Kids in countries with more teacher-directed instruction were also more likely to express interest in pursuing a science-related career. I most enjoyed the stark takedown of a group of education researchers who wrote in The Educational Psychologist that the past half century of empirical research provides overwhelming and unambiguous evidence that minimally guided instruction is essentially a failure. Another lesson I've learned is that the Western attitude toward math needs a little massaging. In my interviewing, I'd heard more than a few American teachers and friends say, "Oh, I was terrible at math, and I did okay in life." A Michigan-based education professor who had spent 30 years researching mathematics curriculum told me he's frustrated by the American attitude toward his life's work. "I see an attitude of mathematics literacy. That's okay, we don't need it," he told me. "You'd never hear these same parents say to their children, 'It's okay if you don't learn how to read.'" In Boston, teacher Denise herself espoused a math as elective approach. "Students don't need physics or calculus on a regular basis, but we use math every day. As far as fourth grade math goes, it's essential. Further than that, I think it's individual. It depends on what your goals are," she told me. Few Chinese would ever dream of saying that. The words of Jenny Zheng Zhou and her NYC Beijing researchers rang in my head again. "Mathematics skills are present in all cultures, but it will develop to a greater extent in those cultures that value it more highly." Certainly, the Chinese exhibit undeniable flaws when it comes to math teaching. Toddlers should spend time on swings, not times tables. And the system overreaches with its level of difficulty in later years. A natural interest in other subjects, such as art, drama, literature, and foreign languages, shouldn't be overridden for the pursuit of high math scores. By many accounts, Chinese students struggle when asked to apply knowledge to an unfamiliar situation, or when questions deviate in some way from what's taught. But I admire the Chinese dedication to math in the primary years and the rigorous, teacher-centered ways in which they deliver their lessons. Excellence sometimes means a healthy dose of basic memorization and regular practice of deeper concepts. As Schleicher told me, "You can never copy and paste an education system, but you can look at the features that make a system successful and see how you can configure them in your own context." In Rainey's first year at a Chinese primary school, I would watch, slightly stunned, as he learned double-digit addition and subtraction at 6 years old. He began participating in timed drills, in which he'd have a minute to complete 20 double-digit addition problems. 56 plus 27 minus 32 equals blank. 74 plus blank minus 21 equals 42. When Rainey first showed me this homework exercise, apprehension flooded my body. I envisioned my son becoming a nail-biter riddled with performance anxiety, and thoughts of Rainey as a robotic android who recited multiplication tables streamed through my mind. The reality was different. Just as Rainey eventually conquered the gridded worksheet from kindergarten, 103 precedes 104 and follows 102. he learned double-digit addition and subtraction. The concepts took some coaxing and cajoling at the start, but with the guidance of his first-grade teacher and assistants at home, Rainey succeeded. Soon enough, he was helping to count out change at restaurants and asking after the price of sneakers, and I saw that he gained confidence from his success. How much does a sandwich cost at the local cafe if the intervals between prices are exactly the same? Cucumber sandwich, 35 yuan, 2 jiao. Ham sandwich, blank yuan, blank jiao. Salmon sandwich, 36 yuan, 8 jiao.
36 yuan for a ham sandwich,
Rainey would chirp. Perhaps children are more capable of learning subjects like math, even from a young age. The first step is to believe that it's both important and possible for our kids to accomplish.